So last week, we started a journey with one of Scripture's most interesting people, a man named Nehemiah. And in the Old Testament, if you want to look back in the Bible that you may have, look at the table of contents, find his name, and it'll give you a page number to turn to. And as you're doing that, let me kind of give you just this broad overview and understanding of who he is and where he enters into the world. Because as last week, we talked about context is king, and understanding the time and the history and the social setting into which his life appears and emerges is important to help us get a deep understanding of the purpose for which Nehemiah existed and why he was called to do the things we'll see him do over the course of the next couple of weeks and months. And so let me give you just a quick recap without detailing everything. But again, if you missed last week, we encourage you to go back and watch the video to have this broader understanding of Nehemiah's life and the time and history in which we're talking about. And so a long time before Nehemiah, his people, God's people, was given a covenant and a promise by God. God met with a man named Abraham and said, I want to do three things through you. I want to make you a great nation. I'm going to make you a man of many descendants, that you'll be a large nation. And then thirdly, that I'm going to make you a people of blessing, that I'm not going to make you a nation and I'm not going to give you a name and not give you tons of people to keep for yourself, but so that you could use this to be a funnel of blessing to other nations and other peoples. Well, unfortunately for Nehemiah's people over the course of their history, instead of being a people of influence, they were many times a people of captivity. They would walk away from God, rebel from him, and he would bring in other nations to take them to exile and to captivity and remove them from the land that he promised that he would give them. And so we find in this time of history, we find the people of God in captivity in Babylon and in Persia. And when Babylon comes into power, they remove the people of God from Jerusalem, the land God had given them, and the king, Nebuchadnezzar, destroys their city, destroys the temple of God they had built, tears down all of their walls and all of their landmarks, and takes them for 70 years into captivity in Babylon. Well, after Babylon is ruling, Persia comes onto the world scene, and Cyrus and Persia take over Babylon and all the things that Babylon had owned, including Jerusalem and the people of God. And so Nehemiah finds his people spread all across the world. Some, a few, remained in Jerusalem, mainly the poor and the sick and the frail. Many others were taken to Babylon for 70 years, and still others, after Persia came into power, were taken from Babylon to Persia. So they are everywhere, and instead of being a people of blessing, they're a people of captivity. Instead of being a people of inspiration, they're a people of slavery. And so it's difficult for them to be the blessing God had planned and hoped for them. And so their national identity is starting to fade. They're starting to lose hope. But when God allowed Persia to come into power, he brought with it this idea of a king who would be more lenient and more tolerant to his subjects. Because the Persian people, in their culture, they were more tolerant of other peoples. And so God stirred in the heart of the Persian king to allow Nehemiah's people to leave captivity in Babylon and in Persia and begin going back home to start rebuilding their city and rebuilding the temple of God. And as we said last week, that's completely unheard of. No king who has the power of the world and who owns all of the known world at the time lets subjects go back and leave his kingdom to go back to their own. And he didn't just let them go back home. He said, I'm going to give you from my treasury the things you need and the resources you need to begin rebuilding. And so this is where we find Nehemiah kind of stepping onto the stage and into the scene. And while he is living in captivity, he is in Persia when they're ruling the world. And he has gained this unbelievable position in life. He has acquired the position of cupbearer, which means he is sitting next to the king, drinking the king's wine, tasting the king's food to make sure it's not poison, which doesn't sound like a great job. It's like Russian roulette with food. But he has this position that affords him power. He has been given influence. He has all the money he really could ever want or ever need. And to be a subject, to be a slave, to be captive, this is an unbelievable position. And so he has this great place in life, and he's sitting in the kingdom day after day after day, not worrying about anything. Doesn't have to worry about food, doesn't have to worry about clothing, doesn't have to worry about where he's going to get his next meal or what he's going to do the next day or where he's going to wake up. And in Nehemiah's mind, because he has this position in life, he naturally assumes that everybody else has a similar position, which is what you and I do. We think, well, we're in a good place. We live in a country with freedom and that affords us relative peace and ability to acquire and gain whatever we want, because none of us, honestly, typically, consistently go to bed wondering where our next meal is going to come from. Very few of us are wondering where we're going to spend the night tonight. There aren't many of us who are worried about having to travel from this place to a place we call our home in a vehicle that we have been able to purchase through a job we've been afforded. And so we just naturally, like Nehemiah, assume, well, the world is living the way we live. That everybody else must be doing well because I'm doing well. Everybody else probably is doing better than me, is what we typically think, because we like to compare our lives to people who have more than us, typically not to people who have less than us. And so Nehemiah is sitting in this great position with authority, with power, with money, everything he really could imagine wanting or hoping for. And so then this moment happens in his life where his brother and a few other men had been in Jerusalem rebuilding the temple and rebuilding the city. They return back to Persia for whatever reason, we don't know. But as they're there, Nehemiah naturally wants to get a record or an account of what's taking place. Because again, in his mind, I'm doing great in my house. I'm doing great in the palace. My 401k is not as big as I hoped it would, but it's big enough. And my wallet's not filled with as much money as I would like, but I have enough to at least go buy the food I need for today. And so he naturally thinks everybody is flourishing and the city is thriving. The rebuilding effort, the reconstruction is taking place. And so he wants to hear a report of his people. Tell me what's happening with our family. Tell me what's happening with our friends. I want to hear how great the city is thriving. And in that moment, to the answer to that question, and in just a moment and a second, Nehemiah's life completely changed. Because in his mind, he thought everyone was doing well. And he is going to hear something that he cannot unhear. And he is going to get a glimpse of reality in the real world that he cannot unsee. And chapter 1, verse 3 tells us that his brother gave this report to Nehemiah. The remnant there, the people that are living there in the province who had survived exile, is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. And in a moment, the picture of the world and the way it really was completely rocked Nehemiah's unrealistic and delusional view of everyone else in the world. He was distant from the action. He was sitting in the palace, safe, warm, and content, away from the struggle of life and away from the struggle of his people. He was delusional in thinking everybody else must be doing well, but in this moment, he caught a glimpse of reality. And the question we asked last week of Nehemiah and of ourselves is, once you have seen and once you have heard, what do you do? Because you cannot unsee someone else's plight. You cannot unknow someone else's situation. You cannot simply turn a blind eye and say, I hope somebody takes care of that. And so what we see today is just the response of Nehemiah to the broken walls and to the broken people who are living in shame and in difficulty. And in verse 4, this is what he says. As soon as I heard these words, not taking a week, not taking a month to process or to think about it, the moment I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. In a moment, a second he heard his people in the plight of the world, he was weeping uncontrollably. And guys, we don't cry. Like, you know, your wife's seen you cry like twice. Once is because you broke your toe and the other because you lost a football game, right? They've only seen us cry twice. But Nehemiah in this moment doesn't just cry. He is weeping. Not for a moment and then he gets over it because, okay, well, my life is better. I'll return. They'll be okay. Somebody will help them, or they deserved it because look at what they did. That's their fault. His heart is shattered, and his perspective is completely changed and shifted. And he is weeping and sobbing uncontrollably to the point that he is fasting, going without food. And he turns to the person, the only person he knows can solve the problem or take care of the situation. And he goes before God and says, God, I don't know what to do. I have seen the world as it really is. I had scales on my eyes. I was brought up in a good home. I was given everything I ever wanted. And I just assumed everyone had their own bedroom. I just assumed everyone got a car when they turned 16. I just assumed that everybody had food ready for them, prepared in a device in an oven that had food ready for them in an hour, that they ate with utensils that were washed in a machine last night. I just assumed everybody lived that way. I just assumed everybody lived at peace with one another. I just assumed everybody would be able to go inside of a house with four walls and a roof to get us out of the weather, that you didn't have to endure what we endure in the cold and the heat. I just assumed everybody did that. But God, now I've seen. And now I know everybody doesn't live that way. And now I know there are families that are broken. And now I know that people on the other side of the world literally have to walk for days to get clean water. Now I know that there are children, millions and millions and millions of children, who will go to bed tonight with no family. Now I have seen that people living in poverty that don't get a good education can't help the future generations of their family. I can't unsee that. I can't unknow that. But God, I don't know what to do. I am one person. There are billions of people in the face of the earth. I don't know what to do. There's nothing I can do. I can't do anything to help them. I'm just one person. And maybe you've been in a similar situation. You've caught a glimpse of the world as it really is. Or you've seen a face that you cannot unsee. Or you've discovered the plight of people living down the street from you, and you don't know what to do, but you know something needs to be done, and someone needs to do it. And so Nehemiah finds himself in this position. And we ask Nehemiah, what will you do? And Nehemiah says, I don't know, but I know the one I need to go talk to about it. And he just sits and weeps and begs and prays to God for days. And the next few verses show us a prayer. We don't have time to go through all of it, but I want to show you the picture of it and the ending of it. And he prays this prayer to God in verses 6 and 7. God, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people, the Israel, your servants. And notice this, he's not putting it in his prayer journal and say, I'm going to pray for you when I think about it. I'm going to pray for you when it comes to mind. I'll pray for you at 9 o'clock. Every day at 9 o'clock, this is when I pray to God. I'll put it down there and you'll be on my list. But he says, day after day, night after night, which carries the idea of every moment, this burden, this passion is on my heart and I can't get rid of it. And so I'm continually taking it to God. And he says this, he confesses the sins of his people, which we have sinned against you, even I and my father's house have sinned. And he continues in verse 7, we have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules you have commanded your servant Moses to give to us. And so he doesn't stay distant. He takes this to God, and he doesn't stay separate from his people. He makes himself complicit in their situation. He doesn't step back and say, well, that's their fault. Their mama did that, which led to this. They're living in poverty because of the sin of their parents, or they're in this place because they decided not to get an education, or they quit a job, or they were just unlucky to be born in this part of the world. He doesn't say, that's their problem, and I hope somebody takes care of those people. He makes himself completely implicit in their situation and their sin, which led to this problem. And he understands the darkness in which Jerusalem exists, in which our world exists. And he acknowledges the fact that it's our problem, that it's our fault, that we, even I, God, have sinned and run away and rebelled against you. And it is not because of anything anybody else has done to me, but everything that I have done to you that has caused us to be in this dark moment and place in history. And so he puts himself in position with his people to say, God, please have mercy on us. We know that you didn't cause this. We know we caused this by running away from you and trying to do life on our own separate from you. You gave us land, you gave us nation, you gave us people, and you gave us blessing, and we turned our nose at it. And so Nehemiah says, God, I don't know what to do, but I know what I have done to get us in this situation, and I need your help to get us out. And then at the end of his prayer, he prays this open-handed courage that says, God, something needs to be done. I don't know what needs to be done. I know you can do something about it, and I have an inkling, I have an idea that you might just want to use me to be part of what you're planning to do. So in verse 11, he prays this courageous prayer. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name. And give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now I was the cupbearer to the king. So he says, give me success. And we love to pray that prayer in America. God, give me cars, give me houses, give me position, give me status. And God says, no, that's not the kind of success I want you to pray for. Because you were made to be a people who wouldn't just have success and receive blessing, but that you would have blessing funneled through you, that you would have position, you would have authority, you would have influence, you would have money for the purpose of blessing other people with those things I have given you. And so Nehemiah says, God, give me success, but not for me. Grant me position, but not for me. Give me influence, but not for me. Give me money and status, God, but not for me, but for your servants and for your people. And so Nehemiah prays for influence. But then he prays for something else that you typically don't pray for when you're asking for success and influence. He asks God for mercy. And we wonder, Nehemiah, why would you need to ask God for mercy in this moment if you're asking for success? And the last part of his prayer, which is after his prayer, says, now I was the cupbearer to the king. Just to kind of let you know, give you my position of where I stand. Because this is not just any prayer, this is a courageous prayer, because I know that for something to happen, I'm going to have to go stand in front of this king and approach him about the situation. Now, real quick, I don't want to lose you, but let me give you context and background of what's happening. The king in Persia at this moment is Artaxerxes, okay? What has happened over the course of the last 100 years is the people who lived in Jerusalem, who moved in when the Israelites were taken away into exile, people had moved in and squatted on their land and began to take possession of all of their things. When they were allowed to return home years and years before and they began to rebuild, the people that had moved in started writing letters against them and saying, no, 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 king, you can't let them do this. They don't like us. They don't want to be a part of us. This is our land now. We own it. We live on it. And so they wrote letters to kind of bribe and sway the governors and the builders and the counselors so that the Jerusalem people, the Israelite people, could not move in and start rebuilding their land. This didn't just happen once. This didn't just happen twice. These people who were adversaries of the Israelite people wrote letters for 100 years over the course of 6 Persian kings. This is like a civil war type 100-year war. This is a battle that's been ongoing. Now, the reason that's important is the 6th king is also the current king of Persia, Artaxerxes, to whom Nehemiah was the cupbearer. And so Nehemiah is asking God for mercy, because he knows he has to go and stand before the king who had been written letters to by other people that caused them to stop the rebuilding effort that Nehemiah is now asking they can continue. And I'm going to read you part of Ezra. Ezra was the book right before Nehemiah that they kind of joined together in one. And it's a number of verses, and I don't want you to get lost, but I want to tell you, I want to read these to you so you understand the weight of the moment and the heaviness of what Nehemiah is about to have to do. So in Ezra chapter 4, the people that were living in Jerusalem that had taken over the land improperly were writing letters to all the counselors and writing letters to all the kings. And there's a really good chance they kind of embellished on their story about what was happening and taking place. And so the king Artaxerxes said, and I made a decree, and search has been made, and it has been found that this city from old, talking about Jerusalem, has risen against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made in it. And he continues, and mighty kings have been over Jerusalem, who ruled over the whole province beyond the river, that's the place where the adversaries, the opponents, were living, to whom tribute, custom, and toll were paid. Therefore, make a decree that these men be made to cease. So Artaxerxes, years before, said, I'm making a decree that the Israelites cannot continue their rebuilding effort, and that this city, Jerusalem, may not be rebuilt until a decree is made by me. And then he continues in verse 22. And take care, he's writing to the people of beyond the river who are opponents of the Israelites. Take care not to be slack in this matter. Why should damage grow to hurt the king? He says, I don't want you to kind of maybe take this as a suggestion. He says, I want you to go and I want you to forcefully stand against the Jewish people, against the Israelite people, and do not let them rebuild. And so Nehemiah in this moment knows this is the same king, the one who forcefully declared that we should not be able to rebuild. This is the very same king I now have to go and confront about this situation. Nehemiah knows his boss's outlook on his people. He knows the decree that has been made. He knows the view that he has of Jerusalem and their history and their people. So Nehemiah is forced into a tough situation. God, there's something that's wrong with the world. I feel it. I know something needs to be done about it. But there's this man standing in my way. There is this barrier. There's this mountain. And it scares me to death. Because when a king makes a decree, anyone who is defiant of the decree can be put to death. And so here's Nehemiah, been sitting next to the king for years, having to approach his boss. And he knows, just simply walking into the throne room and saying, Artaxerxes, there's a problem. And I know you wrote letters and made a decree that caused this problem to be. But as your servant, I'm asking you to take a different view and change your mind. And in doing so, Nehemiah knows he's putting his position on the line. He knows that in a moment, Artaxerxes can say, who are you? You're simply a servant. Be dismissed from your position, your authority, your influence, and from the kingdom. And not only that, because kings of that day were wildly arrogant, Nehemiah was literally putting his life on the line and approaching the king. And this is the point where a lot of us go, God, I know there's wrong in the world. I know that this situation needs to be fixed. I know kids need to be tutored. I know kids need to be rescued. I know people living in other countries in third world situations need houses and they need education. They need vaccines and they need food and they need water. But it's just so hard. Look at what I'm having to face. I'm going to have to give up something. I'm going to have to give up influence or position or money, or people might look at me like I'm crazy if we move to this place or do this thing or give these people or take these people in. People are going to look at me like I'm nuts and we're idiots and we cannot do anything that makes sense to everyone else, and we just cannot do this, God. This is too hard. Because I'm sitting in the palace. I have everything I could ever want. How could I give that up? How could I give that up? And I don't even know if I can fix the situation. I don't even know if it's going to be successful. How could I lose and give up those things? But God, I know something. I know somebody needs to do something. But Nehemiah realized he was perfectly positioned and resourced to be the one to do something about it. God had afforded him this position as cupbearer. He didn't get it on his own. God had divinely planned for Nehemiah in this point in time in history, much like he did Esther as queen, place Nehemiah here for this very purpose and for this very reason. The question is, what will Nehemiah do? What will Nehemiah do with what he has been given? Now, I'm going to say a few things over the next couple of minutes that's going to offend some people, many peoples, and that's okay. And I'm going to say something that one generation is going to go, yeah, you get on them. Just hold on. Yours is coming in a minute, okay? This is our problem. This is not a generational problem. But I will tell you this, that generations of past have been in Nehemiah's position and taken a step back and said, I really hope somebody would. Somebody really needs to do something. Somebody really should step into this situation. We just kind of have abdicated our purpose and role in history and hoped somebody else would do it. And so let me read you a couple things that I want to communicate. Here's what we need. We need more followers of Jesus who will see the deep brokenness of situations around them and spend time with God asking where he wants them to be, having the open-handed courage to actually do something about it. Because unfortunately, in the past, what we have been taught is that a sign of spiritual maturity is that we grow in our knowledge and our understanding of God, and we just have it for ourselves, and we gain more and more of it. But truly, a sign of spiritual maturity is not that your life is easier and more pleasant the longer you have been a believer, rather, that you are all the more willing to lose your life, comforts, and positions so that brokenness might be restored, and having the confidence that God might just use you as the catalyst for that change in the world. Because all of us have seen, all of us have heard. We live in a day and an age of technology where we see anything and everything 24/7 all across the planet. We cannot say we did not know. We can only simply say we did not do. And Scripture is consistent in saying that we are blessed not for knowing, but simply for doing and acting on what we already know. And so Nehemiah is in this position. And chapter 2 rolls around as we leave chapter 1 from verse 11 and go into chapter 2, verse 1, and it says this, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and I gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. So For just a moment, we have to go back to chapter 1. When we first heard about Nehemiah's story, and he first heard about the situation in Jerusalem, in their calendar it was the month of Chislev, and now today it's the month of Nisan. Not talking about the car manufacturer, but the Nisan, the month. So in their day, winter has turned into spring. 120 days have passed, 4 months have gone by. From the time Nehemiah heard about the situation to the time he actually said something to the king about it. Now, we don't know if Nehemiah was trying to muster up the courage in those 120 days and he was just going, you know, buckled knees, shaking before the king every day. Do I say something? Should I say something? Should I slot him a piece of paper that says check the box, yes, no, or maybe? We don't know if he's just trying to muster up the courage. But here's what we get. Here's probably what we can assume. Because we know the pattern of his life before. We can assume that 120 days go by and every single day and pretty much every moment of that day, he is going before God in prayer. He is asking and begging God, what do you want me to do? I know there's something that needs to be fixed. I know there's a situation that needs to be taken care of. God, I need your help. I need your wisdom. I need your discernment. I know somebody needs to, and I know you might be calling me to be the one to do it. And so, God, I need your help in this situation. And because what we know in the future coming in just a moment, we can not just assume that he was probably praying every day, but there was a point in time where God started fashioning in his mind and his life a plan for which he would follow if he ever got the opportunity to approach the king. He was working through this idea and this plan of how to go about approaching the king and rebuilding once he has the opportunity to rebuild. But notice this. Each of those 120 days, Nehemiah didn't just take a break and say, I am just emotionally stressed out. I just need to check out on life. Every single day, guess what he did? He went to work. He went and sat right by the cupbearer, right by the king's side as the cupbearer. And every single day, carrying this burden and this passion with him, this sense of emotion and outrage and anger, and yet still sitting right beside the king, doing his job, not letting him know of his frustration and his emotion. There's a lot of wisdom in this four-month span. Because what you and I do, especially a different generation, we immediately, as soon as we hear the plight or a situation that we know somebody has wronged or somebody is being wronged, we immediately go public with it. I am just outraged. I'm just filled with emotion, anger, frustration. I am just furious about this. And we take to Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat or Instagram and we let everybody know about our frustration, about our situation immediately. And we don't sit on it and think about it and pray about it. We just go before everybody else and say, look, here's the situation. I wish somebody would do something about it. But there's wisdom in Nehemiah's waiting, patience, and resolve to know that God would do something in his timing. So there's another thing I want to read you. We often speak and act in the moment with great emotion, outrage or excitement, that simply cannot sustain us because we haven't carried or lived with the burden deep inside long enough to not know anything else or to devise a plan and count the cost, or to be prepared to weather the storms that will inevitably arise in the darkest days of our calling. And we just throw up on the world and say, somebody needs to fix this. This is wrong. This is an outrage. And you know what happens 2 months, 4 months, 4 years later? Nothing. Absolutely nothing changed. Because we didn't count the cost. Because we didn't carry that burden. We just spit it out for everybody else to hear and know and see. See, when you carry a burden and a passion deep inside of you, when nobody else knows for months on end, God starts to seed inside of you this foundation that cannot be moved or shaken or broken. And you devise a plan of how this is going to take place, knowing the plan may not come true and through the way you hoped it would, but using the brain and the mind God has given us, not just to say, wow, this is fantasy, I hope this gets fixed tomorrow, but working through a detailed thought out process of how you're going to make it happen when you get the opportunity. And during those 4 months, he is praying and asking God for the right opportunity and the right time to approach the king. There is wisdom in holding onto a passion, a burden, and a calling deep inside, not forever, but for long enough for you and God to work on it so that it cannot be shaken. So that if nobody else follows, you're still going. But we just want to blurt out quickly, openly, publicly, and it never fixes anything, never solves anything, never takes care of the situation. And so Nehemiah goes before the king, and for 4 months he hadn't shown his emotion, his frustration, his worry. He's just been carrying it isolated deep inside of him, just him and God. And then one day it's the right time to approach the king, and he reveals his emotion and frustration. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing that you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid." So he starts to show the king and approach the king. And the king says, "Why are you sad? You've been with me. You have everything you want. And now all of a sudden you have this sadness and you're not sick. What's going on?" And in that moment, Nehemiah just, the blood just left his body. He was not just a little afraid, but very afraid, because he knew if he opened his mouth, this king could destroy his life. Now, what I want you to know too is carrying a burden and a passion and praying and planning for 4 months or for years doesn't diminish the fear when you stand in face of uncertainty. It just gives you the courage to stand anyway. And so Nehemiah was very afraid, but had the faith that was unshaken to do what God was giving him the opportunity to do. And in verse 3, "I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Why should I not be sad, king? Look, you know the situation. You're the one that caused it to be. You know those are my people. You know we want to rebuild the land that God has given us. You know what it's like. Why shouldn't I be sad? I just found out that people are hurting in the world. Why should I live in my palace with my influence, with my money and my status and do nothing about it?'" But look how he approached the king. "Let the king live forever." The first words out of his mouth were not, "Look at the situation you've created." It was honor and respect. "King, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak. Thank you for all of the years of being by your side. Thank you for all of the money that you have given me that I didn't deserve. Thank you for being a kingdom that's tolerant and lenient with your subjects, because we know what it's like to be enslaved and not to be respected and honored in return." So the first words out of his mouth were not, "Look at the situation," but honor and respect. And just for just a moment, without sounding like the old guy in the room and without everybody over 35 cheering when it's over, let me give you a couple of insights over the next couple of minutes. You will never get what you want or gain influence by dishonoring those before you. Ever. It will never happen for you by disparaging or dishonoring or speaking ill of or to those who are in influence above you or those who have gone before you. You will never earn respect. You will never gain influence by dishonoring and disparaging those men and women. It will never happen. And the influence you do get are from people you don't want following you. And so then in verse 4, "Then I said to the king," then the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. So in this moment, he comes before the king. He honors the king. He shows respect to the king, not knowing what the king is going to do. He could kick him out, find another cupbearer. He could have him executed. And in this moment, I think because, of course, God's hand on his life, because he spent time with God in prayer, because he lived with it for 120 days, because he devised a plan and he approached the king properly with honor and respect, the king said, "Speak freely. I know your work ethic. I know your loyalty. I know you as a person. I know you're a person of integrity and honor. And you approached me in the proper way. Even though you didn't agree with me, even though you think things should change, even though you think you might be able to do it better, you showed proper respect." And so the king says, "Speak freely. Tell me what you want, what you need." One more piece of advice: showing honor, remaining loyal, And leading with respect will always garner a greater hearing than any act of arrogance or pride will ever afford. And so the king said, speak. And so one more time, he goes before God in that moment silently. God, here's my moment. Here's my chance. I need you to speak for me. And so in verses 5 and 6, he makes his request. And he said to the king, again, honoring the king in his position, if it pleases the king, this is your call. If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, back to Jerusalem, the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And in verse 6, he continues, and the king said to me, with the queen sitting beside him, because his daddy raised him right, you never make a big decision without consulting with your wife first. So the king gives a glance to his wife, and she gives the okay. And the king says, how long will you be gone, and when will you return? So the king says, okay, here's your moment. But I want to know, do you have a plan? Yeah, king, here's my plan. So it pleased the king to send me, not because I had great emotion or great passion or great ambition or good intentions, but it pleased the king to send me because I had a plan, because I'd thought it out. I'd spent time with God, and he showed me how this could be accomplished when I'd given the king a time in which I would return. You can't go before somebody and say, hey, I have this great plan. Can you give me millions of dollars? Okay, well, what's your plan? I don't know. I just have an idea. Nobody's going to give you money for that. Hey, I want to change the world. I think this needs to happen. We need to fix this situation, and I need your influence and your voice to help me. Okay, well, tell me your plan. Well, I don't know. I just know it needs to happen. And they're like, I'm not going to put my stamp on that. And a lot of times we lead with ambition and excitement and courage, and we don't lead with a plan. We don't think through the cost. We don't think through what it's going to take to actually do the thing that God is calling us to do. We just jump and leap without looking and without planning, without thinking and without praying. And it pleased the king to say yes, because you've honored me, because you respected me, and because you have a plan ready to fulfill what you're asking me to let you do. He had counted the cost. With God's help, he had devised the plan for which he would go about rebuilding the walls of the city. And then Nehemiah, that courage he prayed for, that success he asked God for, and the favor he was begging for, Nehemiah kind of has this moment. He kind of steps over the line and says, okay, that was a big ask, but here's a big ask. In verse 7, and I said to the king, again, if it pleases the king, this is your deal, this is your call, that you would let letters be given to me, to the governors of the province beyond the river, the people who are opposing me, and that you may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And then verse 8, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make the beams for the gates of the fortress and of the temple, and for the city wall, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked for, because the good hand of God was upon me. Hey, king, I know I've asked you to let me go back, and I know I've given you a plan, a detailed plan of how we're going to see that happen, but I need two more things from you. I need you, one, to give me assets. I need the best timber from your best forest and your best land to go back and begin rebuilding. I need the best of what you've got. This is a subject. This is one who is captive to a king. He knows that God has given him this moment and given him this opportunity and given him this influence. So he is going for broke because of the plan. He knows that it needs the resources to happen. He says, I need those assets. And the second thing I need is I need your assurances. Because king, when I go back and I go back beyond the river, the people who've been writing letters for 100 years who have been opposing us, they're still going to be there, and they're going to be opposing me. And I need something to hold up to them and say, look, I've got a letter from the king. Na 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 boo boo, there's nothing you can do about it. King, I need your timber, I need your wood, and I need the best. I need the best you got. And I need another decree, this time reversing what you had done before and saying that Nehemiah and all of his friends and family and all of his people are allowed to possess this land and allowed to begin rebuilding because I have given my voice and my authority to it, and not just my authority and my voice, but my resources to make it happen. 4 months earlier, 120 days before, there was no hope for the people of Israel. There was no chance their city would be fortified and their walls would be reestablished. There was no way this was taking place. And yet Nehemiah saw the plight of his people, was burdened with the situation that was taking place. He had seen and he could not unsee. He had heard and he could not unhear. And he had witnessed and he could not forget. And he knew somebody had to do something. And he knew the one, he was positioned right beside the one who could make it happen. And yet he also knew that God had placed him right in between to be the bridge to see it through. And the question for us is, in that moment where you have been placed and you know you have been placed there, what will you do with what you know? What will you do with the position you have been given and the resources you have been afforded for the glory and for the kingdom of God?